Warning, the Catholic Man Show is about to begin. If you're looking for a dull, feel-good religion, or clap your hands, sit around the campfire, kumbaya, you've come to the wrong place. We are dealing with toxic levels of authentic masculinity. I would say good luck, but luck is for pagans.
Welcome to the Catholic Man Show. We're on the Lord's team, the winning side, so raise your glass. I am Adam Minahan, sitting here in studio. To my right is my co-host, best friend David Niles. To my left is our guest for this evening that this has been a long time in the making. I'm excited to have him here. Mr. Andrew Pudua. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
It is awesome to be here with you. Thank you.
So, the studio, you heard me just say
the
that.
The studio, because you study and you...
And it's the studio.
Studio.
And it's where the studs hang out.
Okay.
So, there... That's.
I mean, look at us. Here we are.
No doubt.
Yeah.
Well, I'm feeling a little low on the muscle side here myself.
So, Andrew, before we get going on our man beverage, that's the first thing we do. Why don't I let you, you have a long list of things that you're a part of. How about I just open the floor and let you kind of introduce yourself to the audience?
Okay, sure. I guess first and most importantly, I'm a convert to the Catholic Church, 1999, along with my wife and most of my children, who are all grown now. Mm-hmm. I have 7 grown children. Mm-hmm. I have 11 grandchildren.
All right.
They're coming fast and furious.
Which is awesome.
And I'm a homeschooling dad. Now a homeschooling grandparent, I guess you have to say. And I also have a little company called the Institute for Excellence in Writing, and we publish curriculum pertaining to the arts of language. And I do a lot of travel and work with homeschool families and also Catholic schools and a few public schools and other private schools as well.
I'm sure this will come up later in our conversation. The website, is it IEW.com?
That's it, yeah.
Yes. Institute for Excellence in Writing. IEW.com. IEW.com.
Yeah.
Okay.
Perfect.
So you can go ahead, if you want, you can skip ahead and go check that out. Especially if you're a homeschooler, but even if you're not, if you're a school teacher or whatever.
Yes.
So, Andrew, Mr. Pudua, can I call you Andrew?
Please call me Andrew.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I feel like I need to call you, like, yes, Mr. Pudua.
No. Just because I'm old, but...
No. It's because every time I hear you talk, whenever the talk is over, I think, no, don't stop, please. Keep going. You know, you're just so well... You just know so much about everything that I wish I knew about, you know, in my mind. Have you read... You did. I know you've read this book, Miss Prim.
Adventures. The Awakening.
The Awakening of Miss Prim.
The Awakening of Miss Prim. Yes. What an incredible book.
I wish I was the man in the wingback chair.
Well, we all do.
Yeah.
That's the point of the book.
You might actually be
the man in the wingback.
At that guy's level. Anyway, let's get to the drink because...
Okay. I'm very excited about
this. I'm a little
this.
Parched.
Okay. I'm very excited about this. This evening's drink is brought to you by Dr. Michael Malloy, a parishioner of Christ the King, and he just went on an excursion to Ireland with he and his wife and tried a few different Irish whiskeys and brought this back across the pond for us to try on the Catholic Man Show.
So
the drink this evening is Tyrconnell. It's an Irish single malt Irish whiskey. And I'm really excited about it because, one, Dave, I feel like that we haven't had enough Irish whiskeys on the show. Mm-hmm. As a man whose family is from Cork, Ireland,
yeah.
I feel like that I'm not maybe doing justice to my family by at least representing having some Irish whiskey. But Tyrconnell is a very light, refreshing whiskey, and... Actually, on the bottle, if you'll see here, it is a... Here, I can put it on the Bev cam for just a second. It is a horse racing, right?
Looks like it, yeah.
And the story goes that Tyrconnell, which means O'Connell in that part of Ireland, I think it's the northwest part of Ireland, I believe.
Really?
Don't quote me on that. But in that area, it means O'Connell. And they named a horse a Tyrconnell. And he had 100-to-1 odds. 100-to-1. And he won.
Sweet.
And so they changed the label about 150 years ago. And
so it's a recent...
Recent change.
Yeah.
Recent change.
In the world of whiskey. That's actually not that long ago.
150 years ago. To commemorate...
Can we have Tyrconnell. These? You're putting them up
I'm
here.
I'm sorry. Yes.
Just curious.
So to represent the winner of the race.
Of the race.
Tyrconnell. So...
Sweet.
Without further ado, let's cheers to Dr. Michael Molloy, who was generous enough to bring this across the pond for us to try this evening. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We're on the Lord's team.
The winning side.
So raise your glass.
Cheers to Jesus.
Cheers. So it's a very light color in color. Mm-hmm. Instantly on the nose, you get this lemon, citrusy, apple type of smell. A very refreshing smell.
I typically associate Irish whiskeys with lemon, right or wrong. I do. But there's lemon in a lot. You get that with a lot of whiskey, really. But it's more prominent, I think, in Irish whiskey than other styles.
Yes, and it's you almost smell a little bit of honey as well. If you can smell a little bit of honey,
mm-hmm.
a little sweetness to it. So, what are your thoughts?
You can definitely taste honey. It's just so nice.
Which is smooth.
Yeah.
Very smooth. It's very silky, almost. Mm-hmm. Very smooth. It does have a little bit of that. You can taste the lemon. You can taste a little bit of the honey. But it is very smooth.
Yeah. It doesn't have a bite that sometimes the mm-hmm. Lesser types of bourbons and whiskeys have.
Yes, I agree. Which is, that if you're going to drink a whiskey, you want something like that where
you want to make it
it's pleasant to drink. Yeah.
The only danger is you could drink it faster. Yeah.
Right.
You should.
Yes.
That's possible. But.
And that is actually what we talked about last week when we had a sour beer. Have you ever had a sour beer before?
Oh yes. I had the most sour of sour beers.
Really?
And I gave my wife some and she didn't know what it was. And she was like, almost spew out of her mouth. I love that sour. I love bitter. I love sour. I love hot.
Oh, well, I wish we still had some. One of our listeners gave us a bottle that he had brewed himself, that he had aged in Chardonnay barrels for 3 years.
Whoa.
Mm-hmm.
It was very good. And I'm not a big sour guy, but it was good.
But we talked about how the sour helped you kind of moderate your drinking.
Mm-hmm.
Thing is you can't chug something sour.
No.
Yeah, just little by little. So that it was kind of a nice... moderator that was built in.
Dave, we haven't talked recently, and Andrew's new to the show, about why we drink on air. Let's refresh. I think it's important. We have new listeners all the time, and if they're just now catching it and they're like, what are these guys doing drinking on air? Let's talk about that.
Yeah, so some people might say, what are you guys trying to just glorify drinking? And no, that's not what we're trying to do at all. What we're trying to do is glorify the byproducts that come with a good drink, especially when you're in good company. It really helps bring people together. It helps, I think, bond, seal, strengthen relationships. Also, God made everything in this earth good. And in as much as things are good, they should be enjoyed and glorified for their goodness. Because ultimately, they all give glory to God. And so when we glorify a good whiskey, mm-hmm. we glorify God. Now, everything needs to be properly moderated and in the right proportion. And so that's what we always try to do. Also, we realize that it's very difficult to promote moderation when if you don't drink anything at all.
That is very true. Yeah.
And so in order to promote the idea of being moderate in our drinking, we have a drink so that we can we can do it. Also, they're just so good. And in the effort of living a leisurely life, a good drink it's a good thing to have. I think every gentleman needs to have a drink if you drink. Mm-hmm. You know, not everybody drinks, and that's fine. But if you do, I think you should have a, oh, this is my favorite, whether it's a straight up something.
You mean
like a whiskey.
Go-to drink?
Yeah,
is
like
what
what's your drink? And you need to know how to make it, you know, have maybe even be well-versed in making it, whatever that is. If it's a Moscow Mule or a old-fashioned, you know, just whatever.
What's your, do you have a favorite drink, Andrew?
I'm kind of a, normally kind of a wine person, so... Red wines would be my first
Cabs
choice. Yeah, or a Pinot.
Pinot?
Yeah.
Have you had the red wines that have been aged in bourbon barrels?
Oh, yes. Yes.
What are your thoughts on those?
Oh, I like that. Because it's smokier. It's really, right. It's got this depth to it. And again, interestingly, you can't drink those as fast as you might.
Sure.
Right.
The aging, the bourbon barrel, the density of it makes it, I don't know, a little... Just, you want to sip it. You want it to savor.
Savor it.
Yeah. Yeah. Someday, when I become very, very wealthy, I'm going to drink more, a lot more wine because it's just more expensive. You know, you could spend $60 on a nice scotch or a nice bottle of wine. The difference is that bottle of wine is going to be gone within 24 hours of opening it.
Well, that's true. But if this show gets more and more popular... There will be people sending you bottles of wine.
Now there's an idea.
That is an idea that I can get behind. We want to thank Dr. Michael Malloy for sending this Tyrconnell Single Malt Irish Whiskey. We're here with Andrew Pudua in studio. I'm Adam Minahan with David Niles, and we are on the Lord's team.
The winning side.
So raise your glass.
Welcome back to the Catholic Man Show. I'm David Niles, here with Adam Minahan as usual. However, we are joined today by Mr. Andrew Pudua. Thanks for being here, Andrew.
It's a pleasure. I'm having a blast.
So we recently, here in the Diocese of Tulsa in eastern Oklahoma, we hired a couple gentlemen, one of which who has been on the show already, Marcel Brown, Dr. Marcel Brown.
Yes, yes.
And then Dr. Richard Malosh.
Mm-hmm.
Is it Malosh?
It's like goulash, but Malosh.
Malosh.
Richard Malosh.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
He is, we have him scheduled.
We're in the process of scheduling.
Now it's to be anyway. Dr. Richard recently told me that of all the people he knows, you are the foremost expert on classical education in the country. That is what he said. Now, he could be a total liar. He could.
I would say maybe he just hasn't met a whole lot of other people that I know that are smarter than me, but he himself is phenomenally well-educated individual.
Yes, he is.
So you'll have a great conversation with him.
We have a lot of talent here in the diocese.
Mm-hmm.
He's one of those guys where when you have a conversation with him, you're just so nervous that you're going to say something ridiculous and make yourself look stupid.
I'm not nervous about that.
Only he's so generous in his spirit, and gentle. That even if you did say something stupid, you wouldn't know it.
I know.
Because he would respect that.
And that's the part that I don't like.
that's what qualifies him to have such an amazing beard.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So okay, let's get going.
Our man gear for today. So we're going to be talking about imagination, literature. And just those kinds of, we're going to be just having a discussion in that realm. And so we were talking, it took us a while to come up with a good man gear today. But then when it came to us, this is a really good man gear. We want to talk about a bookshelf.
Bookshelves. Oh, there's never enough bookshelves.
Amen.
Right?
And, amen.
And you want the perfect bookshelf.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe someday
they may
you will have the perfect bookshelf.
I think if you're not a carpenter and you can't make it, because only you, your perfect bookshelf, I don't want to, you know, go off into moral relativism here, but I think that your bookshelf might be different from somebody else's perfect bookshelf.
Well, I guess it depends on what's on the bookshelf, but I will describe the perfect bookshelf.
Please.
Yes.
I have seen. So last May, I was blessed to be able to go to St. Petersburg, Russia. Huh. I was over there for the Global Home Education Conference. Wow. And I had a few days. I took my wife and we toured around St. Petersburg, which is my new favorite city on the planet.
Wow.
Anyway, there is a museum there that once was, well, before the communist era, it was the royal home of the Romanovs.
Okay.
And they had recreated the study of Tsar Nicholas. And in that study, it had the most magnificent set of bookshelves that I have ever imagined. It was one of those ones that goes up very, very high, and it's kind of multi-layered, and it had that rolling ladder.
Yes. I love the ladder.
That you could roll, and then you could go up, and you got the feeling that you could store an almost unlimited number of books. And it was just majestic to look at.
True or false? Can you have too many books? I guess that's not a true or false. That's not a true or false.
I think that I have got to the point of having too many books because I've started to number my days. Right? I mean, you guys are young. I'm old. I buy books faster than I read them.
As do I. look at all these books over here.
But see, I started to calculate how many years I'm likely to live and how many books I would have to read a year just to read the ones I've got, let alone the ones I'm likely to buy in the next few months or years.
Sure.
So I think you can have too many books. But then again, Erasmus said, I think it was Erasmus, you know, when I have money, I buy books. If I have anything left, then I buy food.
Well, there's something about, you know, just like anything that we do, setting yourself in the atmosphere to bring the ambiance of initializing reading. Like, it's almost like, for me, if I'm coffee shops don't do it for
no,
me.
No, me neither.
I can't get into the book. I'm too distracted. It's too loud. But if I come up here to the studio and I have quite a bit of books over there. I have a nice bookshelf right here that has it's categorized, and I sit down and I don't even know what I'm going to read yet, but I pick it out. Mm-hmm. I look through all my books. I pick one out. It brings this idea, like this sensation of I want to read. So there's something about like having, even if you have more books than you can actually read, I think it brings a little bit of the ambiance to reading.
You know, and environment is so critical, right? Mm-hmm. I think you're right. It's like, you know, I was on an airplane this morning, magazine. That fits an airplane. You know, mm-hmm. just pull it out, you read a little bit, doze off maybe.
Yeah.
You know, the living room, that's the books to read to your children, right? Mm-hmm. But then there's the study. Mm-hmm. The study or the studio, we were talking at the break, the Latin origin of that word, studio, is zeal. So a man, if he's got his bookshelf, even if he doesn't have a whole room to call a study,
right,
he can have his bookshelf, and that's like the study zone.
Yeah,
the studio, the zeal zone.
Yeah.
Ooh, the zeal zone.
The zeal zone.
Mm. Right. And then pull the book that fits the moment, that feeds the spirit,
yeah.
that enlightens the mind for the next day, week.
Yeah, I think there's a difference in, you know, when we're talking about how many books. Well, you couldn't read that many books. Well, you might not be able to finish that many books.
Right.
But you could certainly, like Adam, what you were saying, you know, maybe read sample from some. But the idea of a bookshelf, especially in the home, you know, in a place that's, you know, you go by a lot, I think it does a lot to promote. So when I think about this, I think about myself. I have small children. My oldest daughter is only 3. And we are trying to promote a culture of reading in the house. And so having a bookshelf is very, very important to that. One bookshelf we have has shelves all the way to the floor.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't necessarily use it this way, but we could, and maybe we should do this, put children's books on that bottom shelf where they could have their own books. So if they see us, you know, getting books out of the, you know, from the bookshelf, oh, I want to do that too. And they have their own shelf down there.
We always organized it that way so that the young children's books were the lowest.
Yeah.
And then the books that would be good for the older children were kind of in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And then the books, you know, that maybe they wouldn't be as interested in, we'd put up on the higher end. And you still run out of space.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the sad things happen. the books have to go into boxes.
Oh, that is sad.
That is sad. So somehow we just need more bookshelves. The other thing I would mention is when we moved here to Oklahoma 9 years ago, we put a bookshelf right next to the dining room table. And so when I'm there with the family and everything, I can just reach over, pull off a book. I can just read right there at the table. I don't have to go away to get it. And that, I think, was one of the coolest things. My wife wanted to keep the dining room kind of, you know, I don't know, artistically nice.
Yeah.
And I said, no, practical. That's what we want. A bookshelf right here.
That's what men want.
And then I went one step further. I put a whiteboard on the wall in the dining room so I could, you know, just like stand up and draw things on the whiteboard as I was teaching my family at dinner.
Excellent. I love it.
One thing that I think I struggled with until somebody told me this, and I think it was Brandon Vaught from Word on Fire. I heard him say, like, don't get caught up in reading the book from beginning to end.
Mm-hmm.
If it's...
This is me.
If it's too laborious...
You're describing me right
and
now.
And you're done with the book, and you're only three quarters of the way through...
Be done.
Be done.
Forgive yourself.
Yeah.
There's no obligation.
Yeah. And by doing that, I have learned... that I have read more books this year. I have read more books than I have probably the last 3 years combined.
Really?
Because of this tactic. Because I've realized, now you can't use that as an excuse like, oh, I just want to be done. But if I am not interested any longer, I'm not like, there's too many books in too short a time. I'm not going to labor over these books that I'm not enjoying, because there are going to be books out there that I will enjoy.
Yeah, it's kind of like if you eat too much of what you're not thrilled with eating, then you don't have room for the things you would prefer to eat.
Mm.
Books the same. I make a lot of times this analogy between books and food, because there's junk food, there's junk books. You know, sometimes they're okay. But then there's the highly nutritious food. There's the highly nutritious books. So
yeah,
maybe that's a new way to organize a bookshelf. Junk food.
Ah, ooh, I like
you
that.
Know, cheap food.
Junk food at the top. Make it hard to get to.
Expensive food. Delicacy books.
Yes.
Delicacy books.
So this kind of reminds me of... my wife and I, we're attempting to read books. We read books together. And we pick books from John Senior's list of great books.
Mm-hmm.
We were reading Robinson Crusoe. And I think maybe we picked it... I picked this book. We take turns picking ones. This was my pick. I think maybe it was too
overshot
soon.
A little.
Yeah, it was too soon. The language is kind of hard, and we definitely suffered through that book, but we finished it, and it's like, there. Now I can say, I read it. It's on the shelf. Like, oh yeah, I read that book. How was it? It was okay. You know, like, I think I would have appreciated it more if it was, you know, if I was a better reader in the first place.
Well, and maybe if your kids were a little older, they would have been perhaps a little more engaged. Mm-hmm. I know
or
that...
Or if we had boys.
That would help.
Yes.
Especially Robinson Crusoe.
Yes.
But it's still on the shelf.
It is there. Well, we can come back to it.
Pick it up in 10 years.
Yeah. Okay. Well, when we get back, we're going to jump into the topic. We've been drinking...
Tyr Connell. Yeah.
We're on the Lord's team.
The winning side.
So raise your glass.
Welcome back to the Catholic Man Show. Adam Minahan here, forgetting that it is my turn to bring us back to the show. Welcome. If you're in the podcast, thank you for listening for the last 15 seconds. If you're listening on radio, thank you, because that is what helps pay the bills for the Catholic radio station, including one of our sponsors, IEW, IEW.com, here with the founder, Andrew Poudewal. Andrew, thank you so much.
Oh, I love what you guys do.
Yeah, so if you are listening to us on 94.9 Catholic Radio, St. Michael Radio here in Tulsa, make sure...
Or Oklahoma.
Or Oklahoma. but
or Louisiana, or Kansas.
But I want to talk specifically to our Tulsa listeners. Make sure that you tune in at 3:25 any day of the week, because you will catch Mr. Andrew Pudawa in a 5-minute a snippet of. Do you have? Is it a podcast that you have?
I think we've given you just little excerpts from conference talks I've given, and maybe some podcasts and different things that hopefully are, you know, interesting on a 5-minute chunk.
They are. They're all awesome. Every day I try. Well,
3:25.
I can typically 3:25. It's from 3:25 to 3:30. Typically, I can catch it on Friday because I'll maybe leave the office earlier on Friday. You know. So whenever I get in, it's right after the Divine Mercy. Mm-hmm. So anyway, just
check that out.
Make sure 3:25. So our topic for today is literature and the moral imagination.
Mm-hmm.
This is a topic title that you suggested. So let me ask you this about imagination, because I heard this, got this idea from a talk that I went to of yours at Holy Family, and just the idea of cultivating an imagination for an adult man, you know, because I kind of think about, oh, imagination, that's for kids, you know, then you grow up and you put away all your childish. But what is the function of a man's imagination? What does he need it for? What should he do with it?
That's a great question. I have been thinking about imagination. What is it? I mean, literally, what does it mean? It means being able to create images in your mind. What kind of images do you want in your mind? What are you furnishing your mind with? So in the Catholic world, we appreciate the tradition of the good, the true, the beautiful. And so what we furnish our mind with will be those thoughts, those ideas, those pictures, those words that will come to us sometimes randomly, right? I mean, you're just mm-hmm. working, you're driving, you're living life, you're doing something, and boom, some thought comes to you. Well, where does it come from? It has to come from your bank, your store, your storehouse of ideas. So we furnish the mind with good, true, beautiful language, images, concepts. So that, to me, that's kind of where you start the conversation about imagination. I mean, a lot of people think imagination, oh, I'm going to go and draw a picture that nobody ever drew before, or I'm going to, you know, think of something that nobody ever thought of before. I'm going to come up with some completely new, weird idea. But that's not actually the way human beings create.
Okay,
so how do they create?
Well, God creates something from nothing, right?
Right.
The rest of us are kind of stuck with what we've got.
Right.
So you take, for example, probably the master of imaginative literature, at least of the modern age, would be Tolkien, right? And The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings. I was in New Zealand a month and a half ago, so I got to go to Hobbiton and actually see the set of the movie and hear some stories and stuff. But, you know, I grew up reading Lord of the Rings.
Mm-hmm.
So where did all that come from? Well, if you read Beowulf, you realize that this great dragon that sits on treasure and is hatred of mankind and peace and wants to destroy goodness, that comes from Beowulf,
uh-huh.
right? And so this idea of slaying the dragon, it's an ancient idea, and it gets reiterated. And as it gets reiterated again and again, then we, for some reason, like that idea. You know, G.K. Chesterton, I know you've read some Chesterton.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I would recommend to all the listeners, you know, if you've never read anything by Chesterton, just go get, it's a chapter from Orthodoxy called The Ethics of Elfland. It's free. Get it online. You don't have to buy anything. You don't have to buy a whole book. You don't have to read a whole book.
Right.
Just read this chapter. And he says, we don't read fairy tales to children so that they know that dragons exist. Children already know dragons exist. We read fairy tales so they know that dragons can be slain. And so we love that story of the victory of good over evil. We love that story.
Right.
I mean, every superhero movie.
Yes.
Every book that has this epic nature to it, right?
Mm-hmm.
We love to see the victory of good over evil.
So this makes me think that as a man, I'm very often offended at immoral acts that take place or when something wrong happens because I say, no, that's not how it should be. You know, it's not supposed to be that way. And the imagination is kind of does that.
Sure.
That our imagination sort of like dragons are supposed to be evil.
That's right. As are witches and goblins and trolls. And they should be killed, not tolerated.
Right. So having this, you know, a vivid imagination, or, you know, I think maybe as adults we say, oh, that person is very creative. We just maybe don't say, oh, he has a vivid imagination. Because if you say that about a man, he has a vivid imagination, you kind of, people will think like, you're saying he's a little kooky and, you know, not in touch with reality. But if you say, oh, wow, he's so creative, you know, that's maybe more of a compliment. They're kind of similar and maybe...
Well, probably the most creative person ever to live was Jesus.
No doubt. I have no doubt about it.
Because he could actually create something from nothing.
Safe bet.
Yeah.
But how did he communicate truth to people? Through story, through imagination.
Yeah. Yeah.
He could conjure up this image, say, of the prodigal son. Mm-hmm. Or of, you know, the servant who hid the talents so that he wouldn't have any risk of losing them. And we can relate to those stories better in many cases than the whole rest of it. That's what sticks in our mind. So the images stick in our mind, and then we can recall them, and then we can apply them to life.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. Or the, you know, the creation stories. I mean, so much of the Old Testament is that way. But having that well-developed imagination kind of makes it's another just ingrained truth, it seems like, because you now know in another way the way things are supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And having, because, you know, I always used to think, oh, there's no rules to an imagination. But maybe that's not true. There kind of are still guiding principles that everybody has in common in their, if, you know, in their imagination that you don't, you like, for instance, you don't have an imagination that would, you wouldn't ever value immoral things in your imagination. You know, there are still many of the same basic fundamental truths, no matter how creative you're going to be, or if you think a thought nobody's ever had before, they're still going to abide by those moral principles that you have. Maybe your moral principles are bad, but, you know, it's still going to follow those.
I think that's where literature comes in, and it informs our moral imagination. So we might be tempted to think a thought and be attracted or enamored with something that is wrong. But if we have a story that can correct that, right?
Yeah.
And we say, oh, okay, you walk down that path, that doesn't go where you want to go, ultimately. So literature has this great corrective influence, I think. We learn timeless truths through the good and great books.
Yes. Okay. So I'm glad you brought that up because...
How much time do we have left, do you know, before I hit the break?
Yeah, we've got...
Because, like, I don't want you to open up a can that we can't finish here.
Okay, well, I'm going to.
Okay, go ahead. That's okay.
I've recently encountered this idea that if you simply read some of these classic books, you might not be aware of what you have learned, or you might not think, because they're not factual books, they're just stories, that, oh, you haven't really learned anything. But if you read them, it will change the way that you think, because you come to see a new aspect of the world, I guess, you know, just through fiction.
Mm-hmm.
My whole life, growing up, once I started diving into the faith, I had this attitude that I'm not going to waste my time reading fiction.
I had that same feeling.
I, yeah.
Yeah.
Never mind.
But it's, I'm not gonna say that. It's only recently, and a lot of it was listening to your talks and going to the Idea of a Village conference a couple of years ago. That
I still really struggle with it.
Yeah, and
I mean, to this day, I didn't grow up reading fiction. I didn't grow up reading books at all.
Mm-hmm.
I like was the guy who was like, I went through all of high school and I didn't read a single book.
Yeah,
that was like my thing that I was like,
I think a lot of people got poisoned against literature by high school, because I don't know what you didn't read or what you did read or what you could have read, but I know for me, a lot of what they gave us was this kind of existentialist, depressing, you know, hopeless kind of literature. Why would you give that to hormone zapped out teenagers and say, read this to become a better person? No, that's not the goal.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, when we get back, I want to pick this up because I have a lot of questions for sure. We're on the Lord's team.
The winning side.
So raise your glass.
Welcome back to the Catholic Man Show. I'm David Niles, here with Adam Inahan and Andrew Pudawa. We're talking about literature and the moral imagination. And we just had a really good conversation off air. So go to Facebook, where this is all being recorded. You can...
Or YouTube.
Or YouTube, yes. Anything else? Are we doing...
No, Periscope, yeah.
Are we on Periscope?
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah. We're there. There we are.
Yeah. Everywhere.
Yes. Yeah. Ecce Homo.
The Catholic Man Show is everywhere. Behold. Yes. Behold.
Okay. Ask your question again.
Well, my question was, I was talking to you off air about I struggled with reading fantasy, reading fiction books, because I want to get to the point. I want to know what it is. I don't have a long period of time to read. I don't have it blocked off very much. So when I read, I want to know the answers. I want to know, tell me, teach me. And you were telling me, like, there were a lot of things that we discussed, but you also said there was a reason why men have to grab this back.
Well, we were mentioning one of the most influential books in my life was The Restoration of Christian Culture by John Senior. And I can't recommend this book highly enough, because it convicted me. It changed me. Because kind of like you, I read kind of depressing, existentialist, uninspiring, relatively meaningless literature because we couldn't really discuss it properly in high school. And then as a young adult in my 20s, I was busy. You know, I'm getting an education, I'm starting a family, I'm building a business. And I just didn't read fiction for 10 years.
Yeah.
Or more. But when I read Restoration of Christian Culture, I was totally convicted, because he points out that it is the literature of Western civilization that more powerfully than anything else transfers the values, the character points, the essence of the fabric of our civilization from one generation to the next. That literature lasts. It lasts more than other elements of culture. You know, music changes and, you know, fashion changes. The movies, they come and go so fast you can't even watch them before they're gone, and then they're forgotten. But the books, that is what builds that lasting generational understanding. And, you know, people say, well, what is a good or great book? Right? I mean, how do you define it?
Mm-hmm.
One definition I heard, and I like this one, is a great book is a book that you can read again and again and again and again and get more out of it every time you read it.
Hmm.
Of course, that would put the ultimate great book, the Bible, because you could read it an infinite number of times and get more out of it. But I read, I had never read Anna Karenina. And so here's what happened when I turned 50. I realized I was probably more than half my life was over. And so I had this problem, like, how am I going to get educated before I die? As if that was like really important. I don't know. And I have a friend, and he's very much more educated than I am. and I said, would you be my reading coach? I asked him, I said, would you be my personal reading coach? And he said, okay. And I said, so tell me what to read, because I got all these books, but I can't read them all. So whichever. The first assignment he gave me, Anna Karenina by Tolstoy. Okay, this is not a small book, right?
Right.
So I started, and I try to read, like, get a really serious book over Christmas, because it's kind of a slow time in my business. And
okay, yeah.
I like the distraction from the bustle of other family stuff.
Right.
So I read this book, and I just thought, wow. I mean, as I got more into it, I was crying as I was reading this book. I was elated as I was reading this book. I was horrified as I was reading this book. All of these characters and the truth of their decisions and their life and all of this was just so vivid in my mind. When I got to the end of it, I thought, I got to read that again. I turned to the first page and I just started reading
really?
It again. Yeah, I just...
I've never...
I've never done that before.
Yeah, I mean, well, I have definitely not done that.
But that's the effect of that book was wow. I just scratched the surface. It's so powerful. It's so awesome. And so, you know, if you hit a book like that... Another book I'll mention along those lines is Till We Have Faces by C.S. Lewis. So it's kind
David
of
Bates
a,
will be happy about that.
It's a retelling of the Greek myth of Cupid and Psyche. And you finish that book and you're just like, wow, what did that mean? Right? And you just want to read it again.
Yeah.
Because you only got on the surface of it. So that's the kind of book that, you know, I think John Senior was referring to, a book that transmits generationally these deep level truths.
You know, they've done studies on this about if you want your kids to be Catholic, the importance of the man, the father being the practicing one in the house, and, you know, versus the mother, and how if the dad is the practicing. I suspect that there is a lot of correlation between religion and literature in this regard, whereas if you as the father are promoting literature, if you're reading to your kids are more likely to grow up as readers. I have no evidence to back this up. This is just my gut that tells me there's something connected
well,
here.
Well, the American Library Association did actually commission some research that said, that proved that, yes, children who are read to a lot when they're young grow up to become adults who like to read. $100,000. I mean, I would have told them that for half the price if they'd asked me, but...
Well, 1%, you know.
But it is true. And of course, the choice of literature, you know, that's also the dad's job. So, you know, are we going to read stories that bring the children joy and mirth? Are we going to read them stories that help them develop that imaginary world that they can then go to when, you know, a lot of times kids, I've heard kids say, you know, when I'm depressed, I imagine things. You know, when I'm struggling, I imagine things. We're it's a classical term, furnish the mind. Furnish the mind. So what are the images and words and ideas that we put in? Well, that's going to stick there most powerfully through the literature in the book. So I think we got to see dads. They've got to take the lead here and just, you know, turn off the sports game, right?
Yeah.
Unplug, turn off the modem, whatever it takes.
Which is hard to do.
It's very hard to do.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah. We can be honest about that. I know that's hard for me to do. I have one follow-up question to this. And okay. Adam, you probably have time for another one question.
Okay, good.
Okay, so I think it's, yes, you have to pick the right kid. You know, once again, I have 3-year-olds, so we're reading stories like The Three Little Pigs.
Right.
But I get so mad when I go to the library and, you know, we come home with these where the first little pig runs to the second little pig. No. He gets eaten, okay? And, like, I know it's more politically correct that none of the pigs die, but we're missing a fundamental natural law, you know, consequences. And I think that's part of that's one of the teaching. That's what you learn from some of these story, you know, fairy tales, is that bad stuff happens when you make dumb decisions.
Yeah, yeah. That is such an important point. There's a very good study of education in the history of education in this country by John Taylor Gatto. It's actually called An Underground History of American Education. And he points out that when the progressives took over and the psychologists took over education, they also took over children's publishing. And one of the things is they eliminated a lot of reality from children's literature. So, you know, 150 years ago, death was something that you encountered in life. And that's a good thing because it reminds you of eternal things, of last things, of real things.
Right, right.
But there was this whole move to eliminate death from children's literature. In fact, one of the most banned books in the 1970s in libraries was Bridge to Terabithia. I don't know if you know that book.
Yeah.
But it was banned in libraries.
I've read it. And that was like one of the first times I cried.
Yeah, because she dies.
Yeah.
It's horrible.
I hated it and loved it. You know, I remember, where were they, like fourth grade or something?
Yeah.
Okay, wait. So that we don't have much time. And that leads up to my question that I had.
Yeah.
Okay. It's a book that ends bad. Evil prevails or wins.
Yeah.
Or the bad guy is raised up. Is that a good book?
Well, okay, real quick now.
Yeah.
Okay, look, there's four types. So type one would be whole books. That's where good is good, bad is bad. It's not, it's unequivocal, it's clear as day, and good wins. And that should be, you know, 80% of children's literature. Then there's healing books where good is good, bad is bad. Good doesn't win, but there's redemption. Hans Christian Andersen fairy tales, like The Little Mermaid, The Match Girl.
Right.
Right. Okay. There's redemption in the story. Then there's broken books, right, where good is good, bad is bad, and bad wins, such as Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, right?
Mm-hmm.
The value of that type of book is to say, well, if you take what you've got and you extrapolate that out, you do a reduction ad absurdum, that's what you'll get. That's why the dystopian literature has been so popular, the Hunger Games and the Allegiant series, and that's why 1984 and Brave New World are classics, because we want to see what are the consequences of evil so we don't go that way.
So they're like warnings.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Okay. And then there's one last, and that is twisted books. And that's what we see much more of today than we did even 40 years ago. And that's where good is portrayed as evil and not good, or evil is glorified. And we need to stay away from those, which is why libraries aren't particularly safe places anymore.
Wow. Andrew, I have a lot more questions for you. However, we have to end this segment. We're going to continue on the Council of Man. Join the Council of Man if you would like, thecatholicmanshow.com. Check out IEW.com for more on Andrew Pudua. We're on the Lord's team.
The winning side.
So raise your glass.
And cheers to Jesus.